This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
Joy 94.9, live, loud, and proud from the Global Village, AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference.
Good evening and welcome to World Wide Wave, live from the Global Village at AIDS 2014. For those people that are yet to come down, we encourage you to come check out the Global Village. It is a free public access area. It's here till the end of the week, where there is a bunch of exhibitors from all over the world. It's truly an amazing place to be. So get down here and check it out.
Now, we've got Peter Botten and Kevin Miles from Oil Search here now. But just briefly, worldwide wrap, foremost in everyone's mind, the MH17 airplane over the Ukraine. You didn't think too hard about it until you realized that Joop Lang in the Netherlands, all those people from across Australia, just not able to be here. This news that seemed distant and far away, that there was fighting in Russia and the Ukraine, but it brings it home now, and it can have a real bearing on how international news, those seven delegates are unable to share their stories, and so we are definitely dedicating this show to them in their honor, but we're also thinking about how we can start paying more attention to what's going on in our own backyard. And that brings us to the backyard of Papua New Guinea. So Peter, Kevin, thank you for being here today.
Great to be here.
Good evening.
What I was wondering right off the cuff, Squirrel, was why we have guests on tonight's show from Oil Search Limited, which I just could not make the connection between oil and HIV. So I guess I'll throw to you, Peter. I believe you're the MD of Oil Search Limited. What is the connection between Oil Search and HIV?
Well, Oil Search is an oil and gas production company, and we're PNG's biggest company. We've done very, very well in PNG over some 85 years, and we're now, as I say, the biggest company, biggest investor there, one of the largest formal employers with something over 3,000 staff. The vast majority of our people come from the local communities, primarily in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, and dare I say it, their health is of importance to us, and whether they catch malaria or whether they have exposure or indeed have HIV AIDS is very, very important. Our communities, we get on with extremely well, and there are hotspots in Papua New Guinea where HIV AIDS is a substantial problem, and we're also facing the fact that the government has no capacity to manage it and deal with it, so we take a hand.
So you talked about hotspots in terms of HIV, but there's also hotspots in terms of quite volatile environments in some of the rural regions. And I'm just curious, and maybe throwing this one to Kevin, of you've done some of your research in those rural volatile environments. Is HIV more prevalent there? What's it like?
Certainly there's a number of hotspots around the country. There's some relatively good information that there's some specific groups that are much more highly affected with HIV, particularly our men who have sex with men population, transgender and sex worker populations. But there's also some geographical areas where we tend to see some high prevalence of HIV. And where we're working up in the highlands, that whole highlands, along the Highlands Highway, generally you see, you know, more affected than, say, for instance, some of your coastal areas or more remote and less populated areas. So we're working up in a place called Hela, which is the top of the Southern Highlands province. And certainly, yeah, there is a lot of still a lot of clan or tribal clashes that go on. And in Papua New Guinea, there's about, you know, 800 different languages, 800 different clans, and every now and again, it certainly has an effect on what's going on, and has an effect on health, infrastructure, and certainly HIV.
Kevin, I'd like if you could just to back it up a little bit and give us a bit of an explanation of your role within Oil Search and how it fits into the operations in Papua New Guinea.
Sure. So I manage our operations in terms of the public health programs that we've got. So we've got a malaria program, a maternal child health program, and HIV. And they're three areas that we've chosen to focus our work on. And those operations have traditionally they started around our sort of operational footprint around Oil Search, around our areas where the company's operating, but we've extended way beyond that now. So for instance, we've got work going on in Morro Bay, which is quite a big province over on the coast, and then further down south of Papua New Guinea is a place called Milne Bay. We don't have any oil operations down there at all, but we're getting involved in maternal child health, primary health care programs.
That's fantastic. Peter, I was wondering if you could explain a little bit to us how it is that the whole private-public relationship works. So, as a private sector company, you're actually performing the work of what would traditionally be the government or public health kind of issue. How does that work?
Well, as I say, as a large corporate in PNG, we took a view some years ago that we should extend the health care that we provide to our staff and our families, especially in the rural sectors in PNG, out into the broader communities. And in those areas, unfortunately, the government struggles to deliver anything, and there are no arms and legs of government. So generally, the hospitals don't work too well, health centres don't work too well. People die for next to nothing, and very, very easily treatable diseases causes significant trauma in our communities, unfortunately. As I say, the government doesn't have the arms and legs to deliver, and we decided that working with the government, the central government in Port Moresby, where they provide strategy and policy direction, and working within those strategies, we needed to get out with our own people, use our supply chain networks, our ability to deliver drugs, get out in the villages and start treating people, because otherwise they'd die.
So when you talk about getting out into the villages, and some of that involved some projects. We saw something called opt-out testing. And then another thing was just getting out there and actually asking direct questions to people about what sexual behaviors they've been up to and what kind of exposure levels have been out. Can you tell us a bit about what the opt-out testing was, first of all?
Yeah, certainly. So the PNG government has a national HIV strategy, which finishes up in 2015, then it'll be renewed. So everything that we do is aligned with the Department of Health. And in order to increase HIV testing, we've moved to an opt-out strategy. So women who are coming to antenatal care, for instance, previously they were invited in to have an HIV test, and when people are not really sure about something new, they sort of, you know, decide not to. So we moved to an opt-out, which is a common approach across the world now, where basically it becomes a part of the package of care that you get, and you get told, through they sort of generally do group counselling sessions in a waiting room, for instance, in antenatal care, and women are told if you don't want to have an HIV test, just say so, and you can opt out. We actually get very few opt outs sometimes there's specific reasons because of the marginalisation of women. It might be because they want their husbands to get permission from their husbands, and all want the husband to come with them. So, but on the whole, we can, you know, there is possible to hit 100% of HIV testing uptake in that environment. So
I'm assuming prior to that it just wasn't offered as part of the standard regime of testing.
It's just the way you phrase it and how you place HIV testing in a primary rural care service. It's, you might set up and have it there so people actually have to come in and ask for an HIV test, whereas being much more proactive and particularly targeting people with sexually transmitted infections and tuberculosis. And we know that we've got much higher rates of HIV in those groups. And so we sort of aim, you know, set our targets with the staff to really make sure that anyone who's diagnosed with TB, they really must go get an HIV test, rather than waiting for that person to come to us and say, I need an HIV test.
And you've been going out into the communities and also spreading education as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think that your status as a large employer is helping that, people taking it more seriously, or are people just a little bit more apprehensive about revealing behaviours too?
Got to remember, we're working in an area where there's no televisions. maybe no radio, no running electricity, no running water. So any information is really absorbed. And we run a program. It's, it was developed by Population Services International, and it's called the Talk Out and the Talk Straight, which is talk out and talk straight. And it goes into villages, and 50 people will come together, and usually we try sort of aim sort of marital relationship type arrangement, and there's key aims around that is about not only HIV but integrating that with sexually transmitted infections and gender-based violence, which is quite a big issue in the areas that we're working in, where women are subjected to rape and also violence in the form of what we call chopping. So where you know, domestic violence, but at quite an extreme level. So this program does that, and we go in and people love it. They want us to come back into it. But also another model we'd use is using our workforce. You know, we've got people who are in the workforce or who are major wage earners for their family, their extended family, and if we can place messages with them to take home, and they're quite big people back in their own communities, and a lot of our staff do take those messages back home.
I'm certainly finding this fascinating. I've never really found a place where the private and public sector have come together in such a positive way. So I trust you're enjoying our broadcast, which is live from AIDS 2014. This is the World Wide Wave. Stay tuned. We'll be back soon.
Joy 94.9, broadcasting live from the Global Village for AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference. Proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
World Wide Wave, we're the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. And tonight we are stopping off at the Global Village in Melbourne and Papua New Guinea for the first part. Now, we've got with us Peter Bolton, the Oil Search Managing Director, and Kevin Miles, Manager of Health Programs, live in the studio in the Global Village right now.
And we're having a fantastic chat here, learning about how a private organisation is having such a positive effect on an entire community in Papua New Guinea, and how the role has extended beyond what initially started, I guess, as you caring for your employees. It just naturally expanded and progressed to the general populace, and you found there's such a big need there. One of the things I was wondering was, what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned in sustaining HIV testing in particularly the rural, remote and volatile environments?
I think a key thing is about our partnership with local government and national government, and getting that right in the first instance, building those relationships, and building relationships with the community is the next step. So without that, you can't walk in, you know, even for security reasons, you just can't walk into a community. You've got to go to your village elders or whoever it might be that to get permission to enter in. And once you've got that foot in the door, and taking time to build that relation, build up that trust and understanding. And the key thing is about that sort of a longer term commitment of making sure that we've got good care pathways. So once you've tested someone for HIV, that you can actually, someone tests HIV positive, that you can get them straight into a care program. And that's another part of our program that we've been supporting. And we've got a number of clinics and hospitals and satellite clinics where people are coming back for antiretroviral therapy on a long term basis, and they build up the relationship with staff, building competence and confidence in and community healthcare workers as well, who, you know, are quite often not supported and haven't got someone there who, you know, can't just pick up a hotline and call somebody or go on the internet and Google it as we do nowadays. So we're there to sort of provide that technical support.
And you mentioned sort of networking almost and getting to know the people in a more traditional manner. But I also saw in some of your research that's on exhibit, not in the Global Village, but just around the corner in the main AIDS conference room. I was just wondering, do you find that the traditional attitudes or traditional healing approaches are interfering with HIV treatment?
Yeah, they can do. And again, it's about giving clear messages about that. And sometimes there's people revert back. Maybe it's because of their faith, some sort of evangelical type approaches that you're going to be cured, so stop your treatment. And unfortunately, some people do come back to us and they are very sick because they've stopped treatment, because they've gone and taken herbs or their own local, their church sometimes. Not all of the churches, but there's a very much minority. We've got some fantastic faith-based services. The Catholic HIV AIDS services, Anglicare, do some fantastic work in PNG with HIV.
No, thank you for that, Kevin. And Peter, just curious, so Oil Search, looking to the future, are you thinking of extending and expanding this program? Its successes, would it be in other countries or just in PNG in general? What's the future hold?
Well, we're a PNG specialist, so 99% of all our assets are up in Papua New Guinea. So it's unlikely that we'll move out of our home base. Our reality is that the need in Papua New Guinea is so enormous. That we will inevitably concentrate in there. We're lucky enough to be primary recipient and a sub-recipient of global fund monies, so we get funding from outside sources to concentrate on various areas in HIV AIDS management, TB and malaria, etc. With other people's money, we put substantial funds back into the programs ourselves. But as we get bigger and a successful company, we're very keen to build those programs further. The need is enormous. I mean, you see people dying every day for really nothing, and stigma and social pressures in Papua New Guinea are really extreme. And the need drives us as a company, and a PNG company specifically, to do more, but also try and get the government to do more. Give them the arms and legs and wheels to get out there and do their job.
Yes, well, thank you, and thank you. That's Peter Bolton, Oil Search Managing Director, and also Kevin Miles, Manager of Health Programs, based out there in PNG, and they have been talking to us about the difference that they are making. You're listening to the Worldwide Wave.
The new Joy 94.9 smartphone app. It's out now, it's free, and it's user-friendly. We promise. See joy.org.au for more details.
Joy 94.9 at AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference. Catch up on interviews, events, and breaking news via our dedicated website, aids2014.joy.org.au.
Got Professor John Caldor from the Kirby Institute at the Uni of New South Wales, who has just been a part of the launch of a new study called Indonesia Test and Treat. The program aims to increase HIV testing and uptake in Indonesia. John, how did the need for this study come about?
Indonesia is a country which has had a diverse HIV epidemic and different populations, but generally populations that have often had difficulty accessing testing and treatment, possibly because of marginalisation or discrimination. And so the real need in Indonesia now is to make sure that populations at high risk, which includes gay men who have sex with men, people who inject drugs, women involved in sex work, really have the opportunity to get HIV testing and treatment if they're in the situation where they want to undertake treatment.
So tell us about the study specifically, working with three universities, and it's across 4 years. What will you be actually looking to test or trial?
The general principle is strategies that either encourage people to get tested, strategies that encourage people who have been tested to consider treatment, once they've made that decision to undertake treatment, to continue treatment. And the range of strategies is going to be worked through with the partners in Indonesia at this stage. We're not saying we know the right strategy. We're providing a mechanism to undertake observational research with our Indonesian partners, but it's really going to be a matter of working with our Indonesian partners, and that's not just the researchers, but very much the community partners, to identify what are the best strategies that encourage people to get tested, what are the strategies that encourage them to get treated if that's the right decision for them. The groups we're working with are groups that have already a lot of experience with HIV and care and treatment for vulnerable populations at risk, so we're not going into places that are starting from scratch by any means. The research groups in Denpasar in Bali, in Yogyakarta and in Bandung are groups that are very familiar with HIV risk and communities at risk of HIV, but what we are hoping to do is to strengthen their ability to identify strategies and to evaluate strategies that will really improve access and uptake of testing and treatment.
Why is this uptake of testing and treatment so low in Indonesia?
I guess there's several levels you can answer that question. One is it's the particular challenge that a country like Indonesia faces is that it is a country where the epidemic has been primarily focused in populations that would be considered to be either marginalised or discriminated against or more underground in terms of HIV, also in terms of social factors.
So part of the solution could actually be working with healthcare workers to educate them, to reduce stigma, to encourage people to test?
strategies that are specific to each population will have to be worked out with those communities, but certainly sensitising healthcare workers and making sure the healthcare workers are aware of the needs and interests of people at higher risk, whether they're people who inject drugs or gay men who have sex with men, or also transgender people who are at very high risk in the Indonesian setting, in fact, probably the highest risk of all compared to other populations at this stage. Before it was people who inject drugs were the most highly affected population in Indonesia, but on the basis of the most recent data, it's that transgender women are really the ones who are at very high risk.
One of the secondary aims of the study is to build research capacity within Indonesia. What do you hope that will achieve in the long run?
Well, it's actually a very central aim. This is a project that's only taking place in a limited number of cities. We can't possibly reach the whole of Indonesia with this program. And it's to make the whole idea sustainable. The ideal situation would be that there are people in Indonesia who will take on the leadership role in doing both the research but also the rollout of programs with ongoing evaluation and quality improvement as the program continues. And to do that, you really have to make sure that our partners are not just supported to do the research but supported to have the capacity to lead such research and lead programmatic implementation and evaluation into the long term. And it's a part of Australia's relationship with Indonesia to not just provide aid that fills gaps in programs, but to actually put things on a more sustainable footing.
Professor John Caldor from the Kirby Institute, good luck with the study, and thanks for joining us on Worldwide Wave.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Joy 94.9.
And welcome back to our very special episode of Worldwide Wave, live from AIDS 2014 at the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre. That was the voice of John Caldor from the Kirby Institute. Just a little over an hour ago, where they announced a new partnership with three Indonesian universities to work on effective programs delivering HIV services in Indonesia. We have with us, we are very lucky to have with us, Bruce Parnell from the Burnett Institute. Bruce specialised in HIV in low-income countries. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you.
Now, Bruce, you were telling us before that you were doing some fairly interesting work just pre-conference with some of the delegates coming here from overseas. Tell us what that was about.
There was quite a big initiative funded by the Australian government, by DFAT, called the Australian Awards Fellowships. And a number of institutes throughout Australia, including Burnett Institute, but also FAO, and also Kirby Institute, who we just heard from, bringing groups of people from different countries to do short courses. Some of them were just 3 days, some were up to 3 weeks, on different aspects of the HIV epidemic. What was different about it this year was they did all these courses just before the conference, and then we had them all for 2 days at La Trobe University at a workshop, so 170 participants, hosted by the Australasian Society of HIV Medicine. And we were aware that people come from low-income countries to a conference like this and find it overwhelming.
They can easily pretty intimidating, spend. I would have thought, actually, if you came from a very small grassroots community group and rocked up in Melbourne and 18,000 people buzzing around with name tags and, yeah.
And I found my first conference intimidating as a well-educated Australian. So what we really enjoyed doing was doing participatory work at that workshop. So it wasn't sitting and hearing PowerPoints. The theme of the workshop was leadership. And the idea is the Australian government is funding programs to build the leaders of the future. Now, some of them were doctors. We had a group from 4 countries in Africa who were focused on pediatrics and maternal and child transmission, but looking at what kind of research can we do to, same as we just heard from John Caldor, encourage people to get tested and go on treatment. Other groups like the FAO group had about 50 people from regional networks of men who have sex with men in Asia, networks of people with HIV, sex worker networks, and they were teaching them about community leadership, how to do advocacy with governments. So we spanned a broad range of things, and then to bring them together and get them talking with one another was quite fun. Quite exciting.
Now, you've got a very long history in public health policy, and you've been involved with a number of countries in the Asia Pacific in developing their HIV plans.
How does a country go about developing a plan that can be implemented at a grassroots level but still meet targets at a national level?
Basically, the ideal is that we bring people together in a country. We bring together governments and community groups and medical staff and researchers and church groups, well, not always Christian churches, but religious groups, and start by doing a really good situation analysis. Do the epidemiology and find who's at risk. Then work with them to look at how can we make it easy for those groups to access prevention, testing and treatment, and that can be about providing services and focusing them on where the risk is, which population groups are most affected. It can also look at, well, we can't achieve our results. We do results-based planning now, so it's very high-level objectives. We want to reduce transmission amongst men who have sex with men by X percent within the next 5 years. So they'll come up with ways to do it. But then we look at what could be the barriers. And the barriers are often cultural. They're sometimes political. They're sometimes just a lack of understanding.
Bruce, how do you set those targets? Like when you say reducing it by a certain percentage, how do you come up with those figures?
That's where I enjoy the process of bringing people together. And as we just heard from John Keldor doing research in Indonesia, the strategies the community groups will use come from within those communities. And then the Kirby Institute in Australia will help them design research to see if those strategies are effective. So it's very common. Australians are not going to other countries saying, you must do this, you must do it our way. What I most enjoy doing is getting the governments to talk with the community groups and vice versa. We often hear community groups complain government stigmatises us. But equally, for government workers, it's sometimes hard for them to meet with the community groups. And particularly some of our nearby neighbours in Southeast Asian countries are often centralised governments. They don't have media like we have where everyone talks about everything and criticises each other.
They don't have gay radio stations either.
They don't.
Asia Pacific, that's a massive region. Is it fair to lump everyone together in that? Do we need to look at it a little more in a little more detail in terms of how we handle the epidemic?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Asia Pacific has China with 1,200 million people and India with nearly 1,000 million people. I don't like the term billion, it's confusing. Down to some of the small countries of the Pacific, Kiribati with a total population of 19,000 and their main island has only 11,000. For HIV, the most important difference is the Pacific island countries have very small populations, very high rates of sexually transmitted infections, teenage pregnancies, but they don't have much HIV. Ironically, what I've observed is stigma and discrimination are often worst in the countries with the smallest numbers of people with HIV. So the Cook Islands 3 years ago found one person with HIV and the media went nuts and people were saying you've got to throw that person out of the country. And
wow.
They had to rethink their whole strategy. And one of the success stories, I love some of the creative things people are doing, was they decided we have to make it easy for people to get tested. And this is the worst thing that can happen. You got tested and now the country wants to throw you out. So they had a campaign which was led by the Minister of Health. They did an ad, like a magazine ad, with a photo of the Minister of Health saying, I got tested, you should too.
That's really putting your money where your mouth is.
It is, absolutely. And similarly, Marshall Islands, 10 members of the National AIDS Council, education people, health people, church people, all said, we're all going to go and get tested.
Is there a country in the Asia Pacific region that is really punching above its weight in terms of its response to HIV?
I think there are amazingly good things happening in most countries and amazingly bad things happening in most countries. What we're observing now is, so we'll go leave the Pacific alone for a bit. Southeast Asia has countries that are rapidly growing economically, growing cities, and lots of HIV, but concentrated in particular risk groups. So I'm sure Joy's listeners are well aware, many countries have lots of new HIV infections amongst men who have sex with men, or amongst people who inject drugs, or amongst sex workers, or amongst transgender people. And we've heard at this conference many people saying we can't just lump MSMTG together, mm-hmm. two separate groups. What happens in Southeast Asia is some countries are very good at dealing with one of those groups. I don't think any country is very good at helping all of those groups. So Indonesia, for example, has some amazingly good programs with needle and syringe exchange programs, methadone for people who inject drugs, HIV programs in prisons. But they're not so good at helping men who have sex with men, because right. it's too hard to talk about. Thailand, very good programs for men who have sex with men, but the drug users complain at every international conference, can you do something about our government? They won't support people who inject drugs. And so on. We could go through every country.
So no one's perfect.
No
which
one's
is
perfect,
probably one of the reasons why you have a conference like this, which brings together the medical professionals, the activists, the grassroots community groups, all in one place to be able to discuss what the issues are and how best to respond.
Yes, and I feel very privileged to work at Burnett Institute. Burnett Institute's main slogan is medical research, practical action. And we have some of the top scientists looking at treatments, looking at new tests to make it easy to quickly diagnose people. But we also have people who work in the community sector. We're the only medical research institute in Australia, also accredited with the Australian government as a non-government organisation. So we run community-based programs in Myanmar, in Papua New Guinea, in Laos, and one country in Africa. We're not very big, but we're starting to build up our programs in Zimbabwe. And I can draw on the latest scientific knowledge, but when they develop something like a new rapid test kit, they bring us in to help take that out into the community, teach community educators how to make
it functional and usable.
Yes. And we're hearing a lot at this conference of the amazing advances in making antiretrovirals accessible to people. But up to a half of people in many countries with HIV in our region don't know they have HIV because they're scared to get tested. That's not a medical issue, that's a cultural issue. So it requires training health workers, but also training community groups how to refer people to the clinic and give them trust that the clinic will be good.
Bruce, what's something that you're particularly excited about? Like in the region, is there a program? Is there a country where things are going really well? What's a really big sort of a success story that you could tell us about?
One that I came across just this afternoon that excites me a lot is the success in two different countries at engaging police. It's very common to all countries in the world, probably with the exception of Australia, that police will impede HIV prevention programs. They'll arrest sex workers and say you've got condoms. They'll make it hard for the peer educators to bring together a group of sex workers because they'll say you're encouraging sex. They'll raid the bars in Thailand. You're distributing condoms, so we're going to lock the bar and we're going to arrest everyone for the night. And what I've heard about today is programs in Myanmar and Cambodia, very different political situations but similar cultures, where community groups, in the case of Myanmar, have gone and talked with senior police and then been invited to do training in local district police stations. In Cambodia, similar things, but initiated by the government, not by community groups. The big success story that I loved hearing about in Myanmar is they're saying some of the police now will actually help the peer educators. These are programs for men who have sex with men. Some of the police have quietly said to the peer educators, oh, look, I'm actually gay myself. They don't use the term gay, but they say, look, I also have sex with men. And now some of the police in Myanmar are taking the peer educators on their motorbikes to go out and reach out. A little bit like the equivalent to the Beats outreach work in Australia, is we know where there are men meeting.
It's fantastic to see a little country like Myanmar setting the pace there. Bruce Parnell from the Burnett Institute, thanks for joining us here. We are live from AIDS 2014 at the Melbourne Convention and Exhibition Centre.
Joy 94.9 at AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference. Catch up on interviews, events and breaking news via our dedicated website, aid2014.joy.org.au. Joy 94.9.
I'm here with Midnight Punkasitawana from APCOM, the Asia Pacific Coalition on Male Sexual Health. Midnight, can you tell us how APCOM started?
APCOM started in 2006 through a big regional consultation called Risk and Responsibilities held in Delhi, where it brought together the communities, the governments and the donor agencies and also UN agencies to discuss about the epidemics in our region, which is concentrated on MSM. And then at the time, governments were not actually doing any programming around these affected key populations. So that was how we came about to be the regional platform to advocate on behalf of our constituencies at country level.
In fact, some of the countries within the region just aren't really comfortable talking about men who have sex with men at all.
Yes, there's a lot of countries that still have the Section 377 that prohibits gay sex. However, when we do use the health angle, I think the governments are quite keen to work with these populations. And in countries like Pakistan, and Bangladesh, they're still working to ensure services such as condoms and lubricants are distributed.
One of the programs you've been working on is Test BKK, which is for Bangkok in Thailand, and it's a fairly out there campaign for Thai society. How has that been received?
Well, I think in terms of Thai society, we like new ideas, and people are quite responsive to that, and culturally we are quite open to those new ideas. Yes, the imaging and the slogan is very out there for some people, but for us, it's about how do we target our communities and make sure the communities understand the need to do HIV testing, but at the same time to also enjoy their healthy sexual life as well.
Just before this conference, you were running some activities for activists within the region. Can you tell us a bit about those?
Yes, through our partnership with the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisation, we brought together 25 activists and advocates from the region to learn from the Australian experience about how to do advocacy. So there were trainings around human rights work and doing social media advocacy and how to talk to other stakeholders about the issues around the human rights and also access to health services at their country level.
Right throughout the conference, use of social media to get the message out about HIV has been a very ongoing theme. How important is it to be able to reach that new, younger population that may not have been as exposed to HIV?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We did the presentation on Test BKK yesterday. In this day and age, social media, you have to be involved with it. Prevention services and treatment services in many countries still rely on peer educators going out there one-to-one, going to hotspots. But that means that, there are other populations, other networkings, younger people who don't actually go to those, hotspots anymore. And Test BKK is supposed to, reach other populations that's not being reached traditionally.
What's the biggest issue you feel is facing the MSM community in the Asia Pacific region?
I think increasingly funding. What I'm afraid of is that within our region especially, the epidemics is concentrated within these populations, so the MSM and transgender populations. And if we don't get the investment into the communities to do innovative programming, so using social media, being a bit more receptive to new technologies, new interventions for prevention programs, and in reducing the results of testing rates, for example, and making sure that the access to health services is stigma-free and people can come without being judged. I think these are, if we don't invest in that now, then we lose out, and there'll be much more to invest in the future to treat these people.
What will you take away from Melbourne out of the AIDS 2014 conference with you?
One of the main things that I'm really excited about is the new WHO guidelines that has been launched. And tomorrow we'll be doing a session on how to roll this out in Asia and the Pacific and how to get communities being involved and truly be part of these exciting guidelines. And so you know, what I would like to get out from here is that connection with WHO and other UN agencies to make sure that when this is being rolled out, the communities actually get to be part of it, have that discussion, and be able to hold agencies accountable and, you know, and monitor when this is being rolled out at country level.
Midnight from the Asia Pacific Coalition on Male Sexual Health. Thanks for joining us on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, live, loud and proud from AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference, with thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their support.
Yeah, big pat on the back to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for helping to make this fantastic outside broadcast happen. It's the biggest outside broadcast that Joy has ever done. Haven't we had a ball?
The technology is incredible. I feel like I'm in Tron.
It's pretty amazing.
We've got pretty wacko headsets on, haven't we?
I know. It's so high tech and so cool they're letting us be here in the Global Village, which is just a fantastic place. If you haven't been down here yet, check it out. There's artwork, upside down, red umbrellas, mannequins.
When you first came in here, Squirrel, your eyes were bee-like, looking around it. Oh my gosh, look at all these things. And what's more, it's free.
It is absolutely free. So you can come on in and just get all kinds of, not just information, but there's artwork, there's people. There is something for everyone in this place. And there's beanbags to sit on. What more do you need? So come on down. It's free. It's going all till 8 o'clock on Wednesday, till 8 o'clock on Thursday, until midday on Friday. So check this out.
Now, a huge thank you to all of our guests tonight. John Cardle from the Kirby Institute, Peter and Kevin from Oil Search in Papua New Guinea, Midnight from APCOM in Bangkok, and Bruce Parnell from the Burnett Institute right here in Melbourne.
Weren't they absolutely fantastic? I just loved speaking to Peter and Kevin earlier tonight about all the great initiatives that they're doing in PNG.
It's a real learning experience, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it's just amazing.
Soaking it all up.
And I just wanted to thank Josh for being there.
Josh is right behind us on the panel, keeping us sane and pushing buttons at the right time. And we've got Andrew here as well, staffing the stall, so you can come down here and say hello to all the gang. Next week, do you know where we're going? We're going behind the Iron Veil.
No way.
Yeah, yes, North Korea.
Pyongyang, that's where we're going, guys.
North Korea. So. This will be an absolutely fascinating show with Dr. Paula Gerber from Kaleidoscope Australia. And
it'll be nuclear.
There'll be a glow coming from the Joy Studios. Yeah.
Kim Jong-un, what does he do in his 16 palaces?
We're already into fun fast facts. You're skipping the beat there. Stick around. Coming up next, back from the Joy Studios, we have Lefty Pinkos. It has been an absolute ball from Dean, Squirrel, Damien and myself down here at the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre for AIDS 2014. We'll catch you next week.
On the World Wide Wave.
Joy 94.9 at AIDS 2014, the 20th International AIDS Conference. Catch up on interviews, events and breaking news via our dedicated website, aids2014.joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.